Which is scheduled to be at 8 o'clock Monday, September 30th. We're now continuing our informational sessions on the pieces of legislation that will move out of the Joint Committee and go to the Senate and the House floor, respectively. Yesterday, we did a little bit about PERS and also, GMO. And today, we're going to talk about revenue and small business tax cut, as well as budget appropriations. We begin this hearing with an informational session. I will ask the Paul Warner, our legislative revenue officer, to speak to and explain the legislative concept number 3. And I believe, is this document that you've given me, committee staff, available?
Yes. It's been put up on all of us, and all the members have it as well.
I sort of like it because it's not linguistic. Sort of the reason I like the document is it's written in ways that I can understand it. Now, it doesn't mean anything to you out there, but that's important. So the document basically is explaining LC3, the revenue and the small business tax cut. We're still working on developing the actual legal language of LC3. So after we have the informational hearings on LC3 and LC4, we will then go to the part of the public hearing in which we take public testimony from those of you in this audience as well as others. I don't know. It looks like we don't need another committee room at this time, but maybe others are sitting in another committee room. So that'll be the time that we take public testimony, not on only LC3 and LC4, but we'll even be willing to take testimony on the two bills that we took testimony on yesterday, should someone be here to talk about that and could not be here yesterday. But I'll get to that more when we get into what we call the public information part of the hearing. With that, Mr. Paul Warner, would you please explain LC3? Thank you very much for being here this morning, and thank all of you for being here. I understand we're in for some very severe storms over the next three days. And they're not all political. So, Paul, please, would you go from there, please?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. The committee has the handout we've prepared. Great. And as the chair pointed out, these are preliminary numbers. We've gone through the areas that have been agreed to. There's still some details that are being worked out, and that will become part of the language for LC3, and so we'll have that as soon as we can finalize that. The first side of the handout breaks up the revenue changes into the major tax programs, and I'll just go through those very quickly, and then the back side of it shows some preliminary revenue estimates from these proposals out through the next 5 biennia. There are 3 elements to the corporate income tax proposed changes. We are 2013 is the first year of the final phase of Measure 67, where the corporate rates, as you recall, were changed in 2009. The last phase that started with this tax year has a 2-rate system, a 6-6 and a 7-6 rate. The 7-6 rate applies to corporate net income above $10 million. What this proposal would do is apply that 7.6% to net corporate income above $1 million. So it lowers the threshold, does not change the top rate. The second element involved is that current law, any net corporate revenue above 6.6% goes to the rainy day fund. This would change that to 7.5% for a 4-year period. So that 7.5%, we think, would generate about $10 million for the Oregon Rainy Day Fund. And it would generate, it would move about $33 million to the general fund. That changes in the proposal in 2018. And I'll show you that when we go through the revenue numbers. That number, that 7.5% would change to 7.2 or 7.3. The third element here is that the federal government has had something called an interest charge domestic international sales corporation that it is allowed to encourage export activity. This would include the addition of an Oregon IC disc that would have the same standards that federal law does. It's basically you're setting up a corporation to export to other countries. You have to have over 95% of your sales are export-based, and then you're eligible for certain tax advantages, and that's built into this proposal as well. There's a series of personal income tax changes. The first is that the personal exemption credit, which is about $183 for joint filers, $183 per exemption now, would be eliminated for filers with income above $200,000, joint filers, and single filers with income above $100,000. So that's that serves as an income cap, adjusted gross income cap, in which those credits are no longer allowed. The second element is a reform of the senior medical deduction. There are three elements to that. The first is that it converts the deduction into a subtraction. The key practical difference there is that a deduction, you have to itemize to take advantage of that on your tax return. A subtraction, you do not have that requirement. So the net result of this change is actually to increase the number of taxpayers who will have some deductible medical expenses. Then there is a cap on the subtraction. It's phased down based on the adjusted gross income of the taxpayer. The maximum amount is $1,800. And for a joint filer with more than $50,000, between $50,000 and $100,000, it goes to $1,400. This, by the way, is on a per taxpayer basis. So what that means is that if you have a joint filer and where there are the joint filer's income is less than $50,000, and they both meet the age eligibility, they would have double that $1,800 or $3,600 on their return. So it's a per taxpayer basis. And the $1,000 for joint filer is for incomes between $100,000 and $200,000, and then above $200,000 for a joint filer, you are not eligible for the subtraction. Keep in mind that this has no effect on the connection we have in Oregon to the federal deduction, which if you have medical expenses, if you're a senior, you have medical expenses above 7.5% of your adjusted gross income, you can deduct that. In fact, you don't have to be a senior to do that. That number is changing in federal law, but this does not affect that in any way. So that deductibility for medical expenses above the floor, 7.5% floor, will still be deductible, unaffected by this proposal. The third element here is
Mr. Chair,
age.
Yes?
On this topic, could I ask a question?
I'd like to have him finish his presentation, if I could, Your Honor, and then I will immediately go to you to let you ask anything you'd like to ask.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed, Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the third element here is an age adjustment. Currently, the age eligibility is 62. You may recall that there was a provision in some 2013 legislation that only allows the deduction for each taxpayer within that return that's 62 or over. So now if you have a spouse that's less than 62, you're not eligible for that deduction. So it's only for expenses on those 62 and above. That threshold in this bill will increase gradually to 63 in 2014, and then every other year until 66 in 2020. So there's a gradual increase in the age eligibility requirement. The third element to the personal income tax changes is around what we call Schedule E income. It's pass-through income that is from S corporations or partnerships. That income shows up on your personal income tax return. What this proposal does is it creates a separate rate schedule for that specific type of income as long as you meet the eligibility requirements. Basically, it's set up as an election. And what that means is a taxpayer doesn't have to use that lower rate schedule. It's an option for them to do so if it's to their advantage. And I'll explain there in many cases it won't be, but in many cases it will. The eligibility requirements for the lower rate are it has to be non-passive Schedule E income, which means it has to be not from investment income, but rather for active business management. And we put in a language you'll see in LC3 that requires what the IRS calls material participation. What that means is there's certain hour requirements and other requirements that the filer who receives this income must meet in order to be eligible for that lower tax rate schedule. The filer must, from that income that passes through from the business, must have at least one full-time non-investor employee. In other words, it couldn't be a partner who was also receiving Schedule E income from that business. It had to be a non-investor employee to meet the eligibility requirement. And there's some issues around full-time and how that's defined, and we're trying to work through the details of that. There is a separate rate schedule, as I mentioned, for the eligible income. It begins at 7% if the income is less than $250,000, and then it gradually increases to 9.9%, the current rate on ordinary income, if it's above $5 million. So that's a separate rate schedule. The way the return will work is you will have, you'll basically calculate it in two ways. You'll have all of your other income, your could be investment income, capital gains, if you have labor income, and so forth. We will be calculated separately from the Schedule E income. You will not be allowed to use deductions against the Schedule E income. So that's why I say there may be times when a taxpayer, it's not going to be to their advantage, so they'll elect not to use this. So it's just based on the Schedule E income with no deductions to it would be applied to this rate schedule. So a taxpayer will do both those calculations and obviously choose the one that works best for them. The final element of the income tax proposal is to increase the earned income tax credit from 6 to 8% of the federal credit. We just piggyback directly on the federal credit, and that would be effective 1/1/14 in the proposal. There's also a tobacco tax element to that, to the proposal. Tobacco taxes, as you recall, is $1.18 right now under Oregon law, and that would increase to 13 cents on 1/1/14. And then 14 cents on 1/1/16, and then 15 cents on 1/1/18. So those are not cumulative. It goes from $1.18 to $1.31 in 14 to $1.32 in 16 and $1.33 in 18. So those are the key elements. And if you look on the other side, you can see our revenue estimates for these. For the implementation of these components. Just want to say a couple of things because there are numbers that will stand out there. The first row there to set the corporate tax rate at 7.6%, you'll notice it drops off from $74 million in 15-17 to $34 million. That's because the LC3 will restore the revenue flowing to the rainy day fund at that time. Now, the details of that are still being worked out, but that means that the net corporate gain from the going down to $1 million, some will still go to the general fund, but then you'll have the other portion of it going to the rainy day fund. The other thing I'll emphasize about the table is, in terms of the numbers, is you'll see that the Schedule E income, the small business preferential tax rate, has a relatively low number for 13-15. That's because of the effective date. It's 1/1/15. So we're only picking up 6 months of the 13-15 biennium. We'll get basically two quarterly payments will be affected by that. And that's the reason for the $38 million. 15-17, the preferential rate will be in effect for a full 2 years. And that's why you see that $205 million there. So, and you can see what we anticipate the net to be. And again, these are our preliminary numbers. The details may change these a little bit, but these are the basic elements of what will become LC3.
Thank you. Recognize Representative Phil Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I started with, and I've generated a couple of others, if you will indulge me.
I will indulge you.
Thank you. The question I started with had to do with the special medical deduction. And it occurred to me as you were describing the way in which a joint taxpayers could use the deduction, would it be required that both people in the joint filing have medical bills that were deductible in order to use this, or could it be accumulated from just one?
Representative Bernhardt, the calculation for the subtraction will be on individual basis.
Thank you. That answers that.
But if I could just finish, of course, the 7.5%, the floor, the threshold, that's just on the return itself. So that's not affected by the age differential of the two taxpayers.
All right, and I appreciate your emphasizing that issue because it's easy for people to be confused about the regular medical deduction, and this, of course, has nothing whatever to do with that. If I could change topics, Mr. Chair, and ask a question on a different topic.
Please proceed to do so.
Thank you. I want to move to the business tax rate change issue, your eligible Schedule E tax rate. What I'm trying to understand is really a combination of issues. One is, and a piece of it is, the extent to which businesses can change their form in order to get into this preferred rate. And I think as a larger set of around that question is the confidence you have in the numbers that you're dealing with, and what we might do to make certain that we don't actually have catastrophically higher reduction in our revenue because of this change.
Representative Barnhart, Mr. Chair, a couple of things. One is, one of the things we have put into the language for LC3 is the election is irrevocable in the sense of that individual tax year. So, in other words, once you've made the choice to use the Schedule E rate, you cannot amend your return for that year at a later time. However, you can move back and forth the way we're looking at it now. So you could elect the option for 2015 and then elect not to for 2016. So that will be up to the taxpayer. The issue around our estimates is that this, of course, is a new proposal that we don't have hard data on. So we do have estimates of this type of income now. We would expect to see some behavioral changes, some shifts into this type of income over time. We've tried to build that in. And you can see that our estimates, if you look on the other page here, you can see that we do expect pretty rapid growth in this income component because we think it has been growing over time, and we do expect some movement into this this type of income in order to benefit from the lower rate. But the other element here, and what you will see in LC3, and one of the things we're working on the details is that we will build in a trigger that will compare what we've assumed, a benchmark, what we've assumed in our forecast, with what actually happens. And then that trigger will allow an automatic adjustment if our estimates prove to be off. And so that the details of that are yet to be worked out. We've got some preliminary language we're working through, but that's the concept. You'll have a trigger in place that if our estimates are off by a sufficient amount, there will be an automatic adjustment in the rates.
Okay, this is a bit awkward. The governor came in and then left. Paul, you stay there. Is the governor coming back to see me?
Whenever you're ready.
I'm ready. Paul, I don't want you going away because there may be more questions for Paul.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. But I do want to accommodate the governor. Summon the governor. So, Representative Barnhart, you upstage the governor because you came in here. Oh, he has now entered. Please, Your Honor, I'm sorry. I think you got the wrong office. Your Honor, I'm sorry. Representative Phil Barnhart really wanted to talk, but I just want to say it's really an honor that you'd be willing to come back a second day because I know you're very busy. So I hope that you're not offended that I didn't go to you right away when you entered the room, Your Honor. But we came to you very quickly thereafter.
Great, Your Honor.
Are you chairing?
Yeah, I am. I'm the chair. Right. Yeah. Things happen when I'm chairing.
Mr. Chair?
Members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to appear again today. For the record, John Kitzhaber, Governor of Oregon. I'd just like to make some brief high-level comments. I know that you're going to go through the details of these packages, but I want to speak briefly to why I think this is important and why we need to be doing it now. As you know, we've set a very aspirational set of goals for ourselves in our 40-40-20 objectives, and I think that those goals are built on a belief and a promise. And the belief is that every child in the state, regardless of income, race, geography, family, language, home language, can succeed. And that it's our responsibility as adults to meet them where they are and to provide pathways to success in college and career. This is really an imperative of our economy. When I first was elected in 1978 from Roseburg, kids used to drop out of Roseburg High School as juniors, sophomores, juniors, and get these great jobs in the mills and in the woods with good benefits and wages and the expectation that they'd have those for the rest of their lives. And we know that those days are gone. We know that there's an increasing correlation between educational attainment and economic attainment. And it is the class, the kids who are in first grade today are the class of 2025. So we really can't waste a school year, and we can't achieve those educational aspirations, I think, without the changes we've made already to align policy and governance and funding across the entire educational spectrum. But we can't do it with giant class sizes and short school years. So the $244 million that you'll be raising with this revenue package puts $100 million back into K-12, which is the equivalent of about 531 teachers, which is not insignificant. Each district will deal differently with this, but in Salem-Keizer, that's three additional school days. In Bend-Lapine, that's about 20 new teachers. I mentioned the Elgin example yesterday. So it's very, very significant in terms of giving these kids the opportunity that they need starting this year and not waiting a year before we try to address their challenges. The potential purse savings that we discussed yesterday will add $148 million in the of savings or latitude for spending or investing in 2015, and that will grow to $172 million in 2019. The $40 million in post-secondary education will move us towards mitigating tuition increases, maybe a freeze to make those facilities accessible to the students that are coming out of our colleges and also many adult learners who need to go into those institutions, particularly community colleges, to get back into the workforce. In addition, as you know, our working families will receive some needed support with a $12 million increase in the earned income tax credit. Thanks to the Senate President, we have for the first time a dedicated funding source for mental health, which is an historic move. Additional resources will be going, of course, to senior programs. The other very, very important part of this package is the targeted tax relief for small and family businesses. And I think that's important because it adds balance to our efforts to grow jobs in this state. We're all familiar with the kinds of local and state incentives we provide to large established businesses like Daimler and Google and Facebook and Intel. Those are very important, and we don't want to back away from those. But the fact is that the vast majority of Oregon firms employ between one and nine people. And over 50% of the job growth in the recent recovery has come from these small businesses. And so the idea here is to try to target relief by lowering marginal rates to give them more resources to invest in their companies and to hire. We know that this is a new program. We're all cognizant that we want to keep an eye on it to make sure that we don't have any long-term unanticipated revenue growth that we didn't expect. And we want to obviously try to learn from this targeted tax relief to see how these businesses actually are able to grow under these new provisions. But in my sense, this provides a needed balance to our toolbox of how we grow jobs, not just in the Tri-County area, but throughout our state. If I might, Mr. Chair, I'd like to just close with an observation. And it is remarkable and somewhat sobering. And when you think of that, this session comes one day before the United States Congress is scheduled to shut down our government and possibly even default on our national debt. So it's against that backdrop that we'll be convening on September 30th. So the imperative for our success, to me, goes far beyond the policy issues that we've been debating here today and yesterday, and it goes really to the heart of self-governance. It goes to who we are and how we deal with each other, and how we do the people's business. And I think at this moment in time, people across the United States of America are desperate. They desperately need some sign, some indication, some reason to believe that their public institutions can reach beyond partisanship and gridlock and polarization and ideology and act in the larger public interest. And on Monday, the 90 members of this legislature and this governor have the opportunity to do that. We have the opportunity to provide that bright beacon of hope out here in the far northwest corner of the last best place in America. And let's make sure that we seize that opportunity.
Thank you, Your Honor. Questions? Well, Your Honor, you have exercised your right and authority to call us into special session, and I know you have worked tirelessly since we sine-died to try to find a way to bring the executive branch in agreement with the legislative branch to serve Oregon. The chief executive officer can call a special session when they deem the need to be that great, and you've made it very clear that you feel that Oregon and her people are in need of what these five proposals speak to, and I hope that on Monday that we will find a way to be successful in Oregon's 38th special session on these five proposals. I know you have been available throughout the summer. You've traveled the state. I know you'll be available today as well as through the weekend and on Monday as we try to come forward with a huge proposal. I mean, the magnitude of this in terms of just sheer numbers of things we're trying to do is really extraordinary. And it hasn't been easy. I know it has been very hard for you, and as well as hard for some members, if not all the members of the legislature. But we are the legislative branch. You are the governor, and we do have a constitutional responsibility, in my humble opinion, and that's, I'll leave it at that, to find a way to work together more than not to work together. And this is that moment. So I appreciate, again, that you're willing to come a second day and appear before this committee, which will be the committee, as you know, that not only takes the testimony on these five proposals, but also will be the committee that puts these bills on the House and Senate floor and hopefully, therefore, on your desk. So I just do want to thank you. We've had some difficult moments, as well as those that this up here have had difficult moments, and members of the audience are still probably here having difficult moments. But I do think that there is a time to govern, and you as the Chief Executive Officer of the Government of the State of Oregon has called us into session and said, let us govern together. So thank you, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Governor.
Paul Warner, would you please, where's Paul? I want to make sure that everyone who's had a chance to ask a question, Paul Warner has done. Yes, Representative Julie Parrish, would you please?
Thank you. So appreciate you being here. I don't sit on the Revenue or Ways and Means Committee normally. So can you just tell me how the changes in the senior medical deduction, I mean, what is it now and how do these changes make that look different, because I'm not familiar with that portion of our
Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish, the senior medical deduction is a unique element of the Oregon tax system. It goes back to 1991. The way it currently works is that it is a deduction. It's the only Oregon-specific deduction we have. We make this distinction between a deduction and a subtraction. As I said earlier, a deduction you have to itemize to use on your return. So most people would itemize on their federal return if they have mortgage interest deduction, charitable contributions, and so forth. But the senior medical deduction would also show up as an itemized deduction. You are not required to itemize your federal return in order to itemize your Oregon return. So you could do them differently if in order to take advantage of this. So it's treated as an itemized deduction. What that means is that if you don't itemize, and you're a relatively low-income household, you would tend to use the Tanner deduction. So you wouldn't actually be affected by this. And that's why, you know, when we've gone through and done the calculations, that we would anticipate that the number of people that get to deduct something, it will be less, but get to deduct something, will go from about 306,000 under current law to about 385,000. So there'll be an increase in the number of people that can use a deduction. Now, of course, the average benefit will be lower because there's no limit on it now. The way it works now is that if you deduct your, if you're itemized and can deduct your medical expenses, you'll deduct, you can deduct all the way up to that 7.5% floor. And then once you get above the 7.5, then you can use the federal connection to deduct the amount above that. So that's the range in which it will, it currently operates, between 0 and 7.5% of your income can be deducted. So in other words, you can deduct all your medical expenses if you itemize. This change would limit that so that it's, you can only deduct up to $1,800 to meet the income requirements. Now that may create a gap between the 7.5% and how much you can deduct, and that's where the savings come in terms of the revenue, and that subtraction cap goes down as income goes up. So eventually, you don't, you're not allowed to deduct anything under that 7.5% floor.
Can I follow up?
Sure.
Thank you. So the only subtraction that I'm familiar with is the one that we give to soldiers. So it kind of works the same way in that that $6,000 we give to military comes like right off the bat. So your AGI less $6,000 equals your new taxable income. So this would work the same way now instead of being an itemized deduction. Is that how I understand it?
Yes, that's exactly right, Representative Parrish. The other one that you're probably familiar with is we can subtract a certain amount of our federal taxes. So it will work the same way as that. And we have a cap on the federal taxes, so this will work the same way that does.
Senator Richard Devlin.
Mr. Warner, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the back side of your handout, actually, where you get to totals, just a clarification here. On item number one, which is the corporate tax rate change, and the decline in the savings or in terms of the revenue generated from that in 17-19, my understanding is that is actually attributable to the dollars actually going into the rainy day fund. So, in effect, we are still accruing the dollars. They're just going into the rainy day fund rather than being something that the legislature could more easily spend, and probably just as important going into the rainy day fund as they would be as an expenditure. So it's actually not a decline. It's not a decline in how much revenue will be generated. It's just looks like about $40 million is going to be diverted off to the rainy day fund. So your bottom line numbers where you say totals, while you're representing what will be available to spend, there is actually in those three final bienniums that you're showing probably another $40 million there going into the rainy day fund. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, yes. We've put together a table that combines those two, and I'll make that available to the committee. Just in terms of the net new revenue from the corporate change, for 13-15, that's $41 million. Then $42 million for 17-19 is $45 million. So that's the net new to the state, including rainy day and general fund.
Yes, Speaker.
If I, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on that, Paul, but can you speak to the mechanism by which we could tap the rainy day fund dollars? Because I think the senator is saying that, you know, those dollars are there, but they're in a different mechanism when they go there, correct?
Madam Speaker and Mr. Chair, these dollars will go into the statutory rainy day fund, so it has criteria that are to be met to pull those out. And the way current law works is anything above any corporate revenue collected above 6.6% goes to the rainy day fund. This proposal would change that threshold to 7.5, so that will generate the $10 million. So the issue would be, what do you change that rate to in lieu of the new revenue coming in order to generate revenue for the rainy day fund? If you were to set that at 7.3%, then you would restore, in 17, you would restore the current law estimates going in the rainy day fund. If you were to lower that to 7.2%, then you would capture this additional $11 million. So those are the mechanics of how that works. So the mechanism we use is just the net income above a certain corporate rate. Right now that's 6.6, we'll move that to 7.5 under this proposal, and then eventually, after 4 years, lower that slightly to return the revenue to the rainy day fund.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Sure.
And that's, I think, a very helpful thing to understand. I think all of us support the value of a rainy day fund, but to tap into those dollars once they're there, what's the vote count that we would need to actually tap into those dollars?
It is statutory, but it does require a three-fifths vote. And it has to meet certain criteria, actually the same criteria that we use for the Education Stability Fund, which is constitutional and also three-fifths. But this one is statutory, so there's more flexibility.
Is there someone else? Representative Hornhart, yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to get back to the this business tax break that we're talking about. A couple of issues for me have to do with who it is that qualifies for this program. I understand it's small businesses and that you have to have at least one employee who's not an investor, owner kind of person. What I don't understand, since apparently this has to do with the belief that there will be some job growth generated as a result of this lower rate, why we don't have a requirement, at least I haven't heard one yet, that there be some kind of job growth requirement in order to achieve this rate. I mean, after all, we put that in the bill that we passed in the special session in 2012 in order to preserve a particular formula for apportioning income. But that's not in this bill, as I understand it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, no, we don't have that proposal. It's not built into these estimates. We have the one restriction with the one employee, a non-investor employee, and we're kind of working out the details of how that will be defined in terms of a full-time employee. But there's not additional requirements that would be a net increase in employment, for example.
Okay. And follow-up. So what kinds of businesses use Schedule E now? How does that relate to this idea that somehow or another this is going to grow employment?
Representative Barnhart, Mr. Chair, there are a very wide variety of businesses that use both the subchapter S, which, of course, you've discussed in terms of the comparison with the C corporations, and the partnerships. Almost all partnerships will have Schedule E income. We're often asked about LLCs, which are not actually a filing requirement. Most LLCs that are partnerships will file Schedule E under this proposal, so they would be able to take advantage of the lower rate. It's a very wide spectrum of businesses, anything from service businesses to small manufacturing to resource businesses. A farm, for example, could be organized as an S corporation. So one of the things we have federal data on kind of how that's broken out. I can get that for the committee in terms of the industry mix, but the data we have is all by return. So this is, and I think that's important to keep in mind for the committee, is this is income that is passed through. So the requirements are going to be on the individual taxpayer, and that's why we've got this material participation requirement. So if you meet that, then you can, on your income tax return, personal income tax return, you can make that adjustment. We think there will be about 90,000 filers that will be affected by the lower rate in 2015. And we do know the distribution of those payments. For example, about 4% have income over 5 million. That's 4% of the income is above 5 million. About 9% is above 2.5 million. The vast majority of it is reported in the neighborhood of 100 to about 300,000. 11% is less than 100,000. About 31% is between 100,000 and 200,000. So they tend to be in that 100 to 500,000 category in terms of the net income that's passed through on the individual return. Now, the business could very well be bigger than that, but that's the average that's reported on the individual income tax return.
Follow up, if I may. Thank you. Service businesses. So partnerships such as law firms, accounting businesses, other kinds of things that typically organize as partnerships could qualify under this under this provision. Have I got that right?
Rips and Barnhart, yes. If they meet the criteria that are laid out in terms of being an S corporation or partnership, if they meet the material participation requirement and the employee requirement, then yes, they could potentially take advantage of this lower rate if they could use this election, I should say.
And just to make certain I understand, we're not talking about the income of the business here, are we? We're talking about the income of the individual taxpayer. So if I understand that correctly, what that would mean, of course, is we could be talking about a very large law firm. But the individual taxpayer's income is what is limited under these provisions. Do I understand that correctly?
Representative Barnhart, that's exactly right. As I said earlier, it works on an individual income tax return basis. So that's the database we use. It's the amount of schedule income reported on those individual returns. Okay.
Mr. President, my last question on this topic, if I could. If we were to lower the limit from $5 million to $1 million, what percentage of these returns would be excluded or reduced? We're talking about a tiny percentage, aren't we?
Representative Barnhart, I have a table I could share. It doesn't have the number of filers. It's a relatively small number of filers. I do have the amount of income. The amount of income that's reported in that above million income category is about 17% of that, of a little over $3 billion.
But if I could, you don't know what the N is of the number of businesses in that range. The number of taxpayers in that range.
Representative Barnhart, we can get that for the committee. We have an estimate of what that is.
I have questions on a different topic, but I'll wait for others.
Senator Winters.
Just have a brief question, and don't need to go into a lot of detail. But we often talk about in terms of job creation, and you just mentioned it briefly, and we talk about the difference between major, and I'm talking about major companies, and the small business. What percentage of the job creation would we say in Oregon is done by small businesses versus when we talk in terms of the big guys or the big corporations? Often we throw around 80% is done by the moms and pops and the LLCs of the world. Can you have any numbers on what really those are?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, there is a large percentage, particularly of gross jobs that are created. I think the 80% number would be the gross jobs that are created. And of course, that also depends on how you define small business. Can be defined a number of different ways. But the small business sector, of course, is the very dynamic sector in the economy. You have job losses as well as job gains. So they are the sector that often is hit hard when we see recessions like the Great Recession. So, but in terms of net job growth, they clearly are a majority of the job growth comes in those smaller categories. We've seen a lot, if you look at our revenue estimates, you can see that the Schedule E income component is a dynamic component of the economy, and that's why we've got that expected growth rate. And historically, we've seen strong growth in Schedule E income to reflect the growth in those small businesses. I will also point out, however, that the Schedule E income is very cyclically sensitive. We saw it drop considerably during the Great Recession, considerably more than the rest of the economy in percentage terms. So it's a cyclical sector, but it is a high growth sector.
Would you follow up, Mr. Chair? Would you say that that's true when we look at urban and rural? One of our struggles have been the job creation and growth in our rural communities because they've been the hardest hit when we talk about the Great Recession that we're going through.
Mm-hmm. Senator Winters, that's exactly right. You have two things going on in terms of the rural economies. They do tend to be cyclically sensitive because of their reliance on goods industries, natural resources that have been affected. But you also have, probably more importantly to you as policymakers, this long-term structural decline in those areas where some of our areas of the state are losing population because there's not employment opportunities for people to stay there. So it is a long-term situation where we see slower growth or some areas actually decline over time. And, of course, we've seen pretty strong growth in the recovery relatively in the metropolitan areas as we've seen the national economy begin to pick up.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, I just want a little clarification. In an S corporation or a partnership, you have the pass-through income on the Schedule E schedule, but you also have the salary that's drawn out of the corporation by the owner, and it all appears on the same tax form. But can you elaborate on the different treatment of those two types of income and what role the IRS plays in making sure that not all the income is put on Schedule E?
Okay. Senator Burdick, Mr. Chair, the IRS has rules and requirements for the amount of income that is allowed to be reported as wage income. And so, and of course, the limits on the amount of income that we report as wage income will influence the amount that ends up going as Schedule E income. So there are limitations on how individual owners of those businesses can manipulate those numbers, and those are due to those IRS requirements. Of course, those apply to the businesses where you have an actual. You're more likely to have an actual active participant, as we're requiring here, a material participant. A lot of Schedule E income is just strictly passive, which is from investor income, and then you don't have any labor income involved in that because the individual's not actually working for the firm. So it would those requirements we've tried to build into these estimates and assume that those will be a limitation on people trying to manipulate between the two types of income.
And, Mr. Chair, just to follow up, the amount of income that's, for example, a law firm partner, the amount of income they take out as their personal salary for the business would be taxed at the regular rate.
Yes.
And it's only the pass-through income that would get the preferential rate.
Senator Burke, that's correct. They would have to meet those same requirements that they do now in terms of the limitations on their labor income.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. So I want to try to be as clear as I can about asking this question. So if you are a multi-member LLC and you are materially participating and you get a K-1 statement, I know on my tax return what that looks like is I'm paying personal income. I don't draw to the W-2. I'm paying personal income. I'm also paying my self-employment tax. Is it fair to say, though, that, I mean, there's an assumption out there in the public that all of that money then passes through to me and I'm out there spending it. It's my net income as a business owner. But the reality is that is operating capital for going into the next year. So close my books on December 31st, open my books back up on January 1st. I mean, what percentage of this, do you have any kind of data at all that shows, how much of this is retained earnings that go back into the corporation that is then operating capital to pay employees on the next day? Because essentially you're taxing it here on December 31st, and then it goes back into the system, and we're taxing it again, in the very next year. And that's not money that I'm taking my kids on a family vacation. So can you speak to that at all in terms of what you see in terms of retained earnings and carryover? And that shows up on people who 250,000 and above, I think they want you to file that paperwork with the IRS on retained earnings and assets of the company balance statement.
Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish, we tend to think of that in terms of our economic models of the state. And I think the big question is, what proportion of the dollars that we're looking at here, what proportion of those end up as investment, at least investment as an economist would define it, as expenditures back into the business, where you're increasing the productive capacity of the business? Having said that, it's always the economist's lament, we don't have good data on that, what that distinction would be. But I do think that is one of the real key elements of this, the impact of this proposed change is how much of that actually gets reinvested back in the business, because that's where you'd see an increase in the productive capacity of the economy and improve the overall competitive environment for Oregon. So that is a big issue. Having said that, we don't have real good data on what that proportion would be. We know, obviously, there is a sizable amount that does, but whether that's 30% or 40%, we don't know that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Okay. Further questions?
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. A different topic, if I may, Mr. Chair. IC Desk, can you give us an idea of how many businesses and what they do that would benefit from this change that we're considering?
Representative Barnhart, Mr. Chair, unfortunately, we don't know the number of businesses. The language that we're working with now would allow the IC Disc Oregon formation only if they are existing IC disk under federal law. And then we would look at opening that to newer formation of IC disks down the road. Those are some of the details we're working out. We do have federal data, and we do know that, and I have a report from the IRS that I'd be happy to share with the committee. So there's not a large number in terms of the U.S. The number of returns we have for 2008 is about 2,000 for the U.S. That used the this type of corporation. The federal government, basically what you're able to do is you generate export earnings and you're able to defer taxes on that. You retain them within that corporation if you meet the requirements. And then under federal law, when you pay them back out, you pay the tax on the dividend rate, which is lower under federal law. But, of course, that won't affect us. So the federal tax expenditure effect, and I just looked at the Joint Tax Committee's tax expenditure report, is about $400 million a year. And that would translate out, if we do the division for Oregon, into it's pretty close to your estimates you'll see there in the sheet, about $2.5-3 million a year. So that's kind of what we're basing those estimates on. But at this point, we don't have a real clear understanding of how many are out there. We know it's not a large number at this point, based on our discussions with Department of Revenue.
Thank you. And I have a different topic, if I may. Thank you. on the tobacco issue, if I've read this material correctly, we're moving the other tobacco products escalator from 2019 to 2022. I think that's the correct date. It's my understanding that is a very rapidly growing product sale mix as compared with the growth in the sale of cigarettes and that sort of thing. Can you give us a comment on that issue? It looks to me as though we're essentially, by making this postponement, continuing the advantage that other tobacco products have for sale with the risks that kids are starting to use nicotine and becoming addicted, and we're going to continue that before the rates go up. Have I understood that correctly? Or
Representative Barnhart, I don't have the preferred term smokeless tobacco growth rate. I do know that the other tobacco products are growing at about 3-4% annually. Of course, the cigarette tax revenue is declining. As long as there's not a rate increase, that's actually declining over time. So, yes, there is a difference in the growth rate and revenue for other tobacco products. I'll have to look at the specifically on the moist snuff or the smokeless tobacco to see what that specific category has grown at. Of course, the changes that you made in 2009, the legislature made, changed it from an OTP, other tobacco product, with a percent of wholesale price as the basis for the tax, to a per ounce basis. And a per ounce basis, this does mean you get slower growth over time, because it's just a quantity, it's not a price times quantity adjustment. So that category has now grown more slowly since that change, and we would expect that to continue in the future.
All right. So if I could, Mr. Chair, follow up on that. So in effect, what we're doing is increasing the tax on the declining revenue portion of the tobacco products, which is great. I that's fine to do. But we're going to postpone our increase in the area where there's an increase in usage and therefore probably an increase in the addiction rate for nicotine. Have I got that right?
Representative Barnhart, in terms of the mechanics of the revenue, the escalator clause is built in for 2019, and that would adjust those per ounce tax rates on the moist snuff based on changes in the CPI. This proposal would, in effect, delay that for 3 years before that kicks in.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your indulgence.
Thank you. Paul, thank you very much for coming here this morning. Thank you for all you're doing to help us get ready for Monday.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So we will now go to Legislative Concept 4, and Mr. Ken Rocco, if you would please come and talk to us about the budget appropriations.
Is that an LC draft?
Yes.
And I believe...
Mr. Chair, members, Ken Rocco, Legislative Fiscal Office. I'm happy to report to you that compared to the other LC drafts you've been looking at, LC 4 is relatively simple. So I thought what I'd do is go through the seven operative sections of the draft and then give you a little more information that's not included in the draft using a display that I believe is being handed out to you and has been made available on all this. So LC4 is the proposed appropriation bill for the special session. Section 1 appropriates $100 million to the state school fund for the 13-15 biennium. Section 2 appropriates $15 million to the community college support fund. Section 3 appropriates $25 million to the Department of Administrative Services for use by the Oregon University System. Section 4 appropriates $10 million to the Department of Human Services for aging and people with disabilities and developmental disabilities programs. Section 5 appropriates $26 million to the Emergency Board as a special purpose appropriation for use for state agencies to fund senior services. Section 6 appropriates $5 million to the Department of Transportation for the Public Transit Division's Elderly and People with Disabilities Transportation Program. And Section 7 increases the other funds expenditure limitation for the Oregon Health Authority by $10 million for community mental health services. And then the bill also has an emergency clause. So just to give you a little more what's behind some of these numbers, the state school fund, $100 million, would increase the biennial total state school fund for the 13-15 biennium to $6.65 billion. There's language in the bill that directs the Oregon University System that the $25 million is to be used to limit tuition increases. Based on some conversations we've had with the system, we think that means that they would have a zero increase for the second school year, and they may be able to further limit tuition increases in the winter and spring terms of the current school year. Not eliminating all increases, but limiting from the proposed 3.5 down to roughly around 2%. The $15 million for the Community College Support Fund is also to limit tuition increases, and based on information we've received from the department, it looks like it will not entirely eliminate all increases, but it's basically a community college decision. Most community colleges said it would go a long ways to making a 0% increase in tuition in the second school year. For the mental health programs, there are currently two planned expenditures, $5.8 million for children and young adult mental health. And this would fully fund the system that was envisioned with Senate Bill 823 from last session. So there are various components of those that we can get you more information on if you'd like. There's another $4.2 million that's for adult mental health crisis services, and this is for community-based coordinated services for individuals in crisis. Again, both of these are from the cigarette tax increase. There was some discussion about looking into some other possible uses for the in adult mental health services for the remaining $10 million. So I think that the decision was that we would wait until the 2014 session, and at that time we would increase the limitation for the Oregon Health Authority by another $10 million to take care of programs such as supported housing and peer-delivered services for persons with mental illness. On the senior program side, there's $10 million being provided to expand the Oregon Project independence capacity in the Department of Human Services and also to maintain system purchasing power. The $5 million for the Department of Transportation would offset some declines in non-general fund revenue that they're looking at and to provide additional community options for those transit services. And then the $26 million special purpose appropriation is similar to the $10 million for the Oregon Health Authority. This would be set aside, and in February there could be use of these additional dollars for programs such as additional funding for local area agencies on agency, approving services and treatment practices for older adults with mental illness, and backfilling the quality of care fund. So at this point, Mr. Chair, those are the proposed appropriations and allocations of the revenue package that you just heard about.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just more of a statement than a question, just so that people understand that the co-chairs of Ways and Means have discussed this proposal, and we've discussed it with our subcommittee chairs for the Human Services Sub, and our intent with both the $26 million that's visible on this and the $10 million that is not actually a SPA, because it cannot be a SPA, which is the $10 million additional in tobacco-related revenue that's not on here, is that there will be a thorough discussion of those items in the February session. Not only will the full subcommittee be engaged in that, but the full Ways and Means Committee and the members of the legislature will be engaged in that. But we wanted to make sure that these dollars were spent as well as they could be spent. So we believe there's a little bit more work that needs to be done. And just so I can state from my standpoint, I can't speak from Representative Buckley's standpoint, but I have a feeling he'd have a similar viewpoint to mine. These dollars are, in a sense, sequestered. We do not expect them to be part of any rebalance proposal that comes from DHS or OHA. So they're literally not available to them. These are supposed to be for improvements in programs. So our full anticipation is that we will dedicate these dollars in the February session. But we think it's a little premature to dedicate all of these dollars, because we want to make sure that the remainder in the dollars, the 26 in the SPA and the $10 million left in tobacco-related revenue dedicated to mental health, is well spent.
Representative Parrish, please.
Well, and I'm glad that my senator is a budget wonk and actually answered my question. What's the distribution of those dollars, particularly for mental health, and are we anticipating that that's going to go through CCOs or money delivered to counties? But, you know, you said February. We will make those adjustments.
That's probably... Ms. Chairman, Representative Parrish, that's probably an open discussion. I think the current feeling now is that the $10 million in mental health, well, CCOs have their own needs, and they are we've met a lot of those. These dollars are probably more meant on the community basis and out into basic county and nonprofit programs.
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about timing and the extent to which this can be managed from a timing point of view. We were just hearing about LC3. LC3, of course, can't go into effect for 90 days because of the constitutional provisions. During that 90-day period, it could be referred to the ballot. Unless we made some change in the timing, that would go on the November ballot of next year. What are the provisions in this bill, or what are the mechanisms that would be possible to deal with the imbalance in the event that were to occur?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, first of all, the there is a delay in collection of all these monies, as you say, because of the 91-day thing. So the revenue projections that Mr. Warner was using are based on that delayed implementation. So if they are referred and the revenue doesn't appear, then we would just have to make adjustments to budgets either at there's opportunities either next in February or next session. The monies appropriated to the emergency board would be possible to not use those. The emergency board cannot reduce budgets, but it can add to budgets. So I think there are sufficient mechanisms to deal with that instance if it does occur.
And a comment, if I may, it occurs to me that we may be missing a bill having to do with the possibility of a referral of LC3, a referendum on LC3.
Are there any further questions, comments?
Senator
Winters, do you wish to speak?
Just to add on just a little bit, because the budget folks are very, very cognizant of the one feature for us, and I want to thank our LFO staff, because unlike the federal level, we don't spend more than what we have to take in. So if there's a change, we do budget adjustments routinely, don't we, Mr. Co-Chair of Budget? And it's something that we're accustomed to doing in the bowels of the budget. So just so that those who are listening out there, the state of Oregon and most states operate within their revenue parameters that they have.
Thank you, Ken. Good luck in the postseason.
Thank you very much.
They don't know what...
No one in the room understands that, but you and I clearly understand it.
Yeah.
Yes, we do understand that.
I'll support you until they meet.
I understand. So it's that moment that we go to the public to tell us what you think about these two proposals. Also, I said in the beginning, and then the good speaker said it yesterday, if you wish to speak about the two proposals we talked about yesterday, we will also allow testimony on the PERS as well as the GMO. So please feel free. We're trying to get as much testimony as possible. I don't know if there's people in the other rooms, but here's the situation. The speaker did brilliantly with this yesterday. We have a clock. You all are going to be on the clock. I'm on the clock, which means in order to accommodate everyone, and to be fair, there's a two-minute limit to the public testimony. And I struggle with that. I know the speaker did, because the most difficult time is when you got to cut someone off. It's just not nice to cut someone off. So please, the green light, go for it. Yellow light, well, go for it, but be aware. Red light, game over. And so I just really don't like to stop you, and I mean it. I really don't, because it's just awkward. So please work with us on that. I don't know why the good representative Mike McLean's laughing. It's hard, and you do know you can written testimony. We do read the written testimony, believe me, and it's also on online. So with that, we're going to I'll call up groups of three to four, depending. Yes,
Senator.
Oh yes, I'm going to get to the Honorable Senator Whitsitt. I'm going to call up groups three to four, and if I don't pronounce your names right, please don't hold it against me. I don't do well sometimes. I'm not trying to offend anybody. I'll do the best I can, and you can always come up here and correct me mightily. And by the way, when you do testify, even though I've called you by name, you do need to put your name on the record. So you have to start your testimony by saying, my name is Peter Courtney. Don't say that, because that you're not Peter Courtney. But I'm just giving you an example. You say your name, because we're keeping a record, and we do need the name, even though I've said it. With that, Senator Doug Whitsitt, do you wish to testify?
I don't.
You don't wish to testify? You've been sitting here for 2 days. You don't wish to talk to us? Okay. All right. Are there any other legislators out there in the hallway or any other place that wish to speak to us? Because I don't want to offend anybody. That happens in this business. All right. This is my first list right here, right? Okay. So I think we're going to have to pull a fourth chair up in order to accommodate this, because there's a group of three that want to be together. There's a brotherhood here, apparently. Steve Buckstein, J.L. Wilson, Eric Blackledge, and Bob Cornelis. Would you four please come forward? And while you four are there, let me tell you, the next group will be Randy Mullen.
Miller.
Well, yeah, with all due respect. Don't mean to offend Randy Miller.
The good Randy Miller.
John Calhoun.
Stop it.
Jessica Stewart and John Mullen. You get ready. You're going to be the next one on the field. So those next four will be the next ones who can take the field after this group presents to us. So, Steve, would you get to open the public testimony on LC3? So please, your name, please.
Thank you. Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Steve Buckstein. I'm senior policy analyst and founder of Cascade Policy Institute in Portland, a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank. I'm here to endorse part of LC3. The part with the small business tax cuts. And I just wanted to give you an example of one of the things that I think isn't thought about. I have some written testimony longer, but in terms of the positive unintended consequences maybe of small business tax cuts, one of the opponents of these tax cuts in the regular session gave the example to a Senate hearing that his washing machine repairman probably wouldn't add an employee or buy a truck because of these small business tax cuts. And I agreed with him. I said that's probably true. But I think what could happen is that someone looking at Oregon, either here or from somewhere else, could open a washing machine manufacturing facility in Oregon because of these small business tax cuts. Washing machines are manufactured, I believe, in four other states. This is just an example of how a real small business may not add an employee, but a bigger business may start because of these unintended positive consequences. I think you and all of us need to understand that more and more in this modern world, people and capital are mobile. They can come into the state, they can go out of the state. And Oregon has relatively high tax rates now, especially on small businesses. And that is a big stop sign for people coming into the state, people going out of the state. So if you want to look at creating jobs, and I have it on good authority that all of you on this panel, and I think all the legislators and the governor, want to create jobs in Oregon, this small business tax cut is your chance to do it. Thank you.
Thank you. J.L. Wilson.
Thank you. Good morning, committee. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing Associated Oregon Industries. I wanted to indicate for the record that AOI supports LC3 and all other components of the agreed-upon bargain. Specifically with regard to LC3, I want to recognize our C-Corps because they're clearly being asked to pay more to make this deal work. So are a lot of other groups. And I want to recognize them, but also want to convey to you that their willingness through our association and other business associations that will testify behind me, their willingness to advance this agreement and move our state forward is what dominates their thinking, and so they're supportive. I also want to indicate that the small business tax cut is a very significant pro-growth tax policy for our small companies, and something that's hard to appreciate if you're not in business, and that is many small business owners, probably all of them, is certainly my experience, pay individual taxes on money that their business makes that they never see, because the money has to be kept in the company in order to make payroll, keep cash flow, acquire capital, and similar things that we all want and grow our economy. So we support the legislation in its entirety, as well as any other and all other pieces of the so-called grand bargain, and encourage your support, too. Thank you.
Thank you. Eric?
Chair Courtney, Chair Kotek. I'd also like to speak in support not only the entire package, but specifically in support of the small business tax provisions. That small businesses do employ about 55.
Excuse me, Eric, you got to say who you are.
I'm sorry. Hey, Eric Blackledge, Chair, President of Blackledge Furniture and Corvallis, okay. And former Chair of the Governor's Small Business Council. And I would like to support the measure and also specifically support the small business tax provisions. Small businesses do employ about 55.5% of all of the employees in the state of Oregon, and are very important to the Oregon economy and to the growth of the Oregon economy. Between 2007 and 2011, small businesses lost between 13 and 10%, depending upon the size of the business, of total employees. So they've been heavily impacted by the recession, by the economic changes that have occurred in our economy. They were also impacted noticeably by the increase in the personal income tax, which was passed to get the state out of its last financial situation. And that has had a marked impact on the competitiveness of Oregon small businesses, particularly pass-through entities. About 90% of Oregon small businesses pay their taxes on their personal return as pass-through entities, comparable to the federal rate. And this system is heavily regulated, even though this differentiation is relatively new in Oregon. The federal tax system does fairly clearly differentiate between salary income and actual small business income, and there is a very intensive history of IRS regulation to help clarify many of the issues that you raised today in terms of exactly what kind of income would be considered. But the important point that you need to understand is that Oregon, in terms of pass-through income taxation, has the fourth highest level of income taxation on that pass-through income of any state in the United States. Ours at 9.9% maximum compares to only 45% in terms of an average. I have attached to my written testimony a breakout of each of the state taxes in terms of the amount of tax on pass-through income, and also a profile of the Oregon small business community. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Eric. Rob, please. Please, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Rob Cornelis. I represent ESCO Corporation, a 100-year-old private organ manufacturer that employs nearly 1,000 workers in our state. Prior to joining ESCO in 2012, I had my own 12th-and-based sports marketing firm for 18 years. In men's team sports, they often say a tie is like kissing your sister. No one wins, yet no one loses. That's the way many will look at this series of bills under consideration. No large employer feels they've won when their already high tax rates go higher, especially in a persistently pesky economy. At the same time, no PERS recipient will openly admit victory with benefits being curtailed. But you can usually tell a good negotiation has taken place when a deal gets done and both sides walk away unhappy. At ESCO, when times are tough and we lose momentum or market share, we recognize we need to change. Sticking with the status quo is a ticket to irrelevance. Likewise, in Oregon, when we can no longer provide some economic certainty to our families, our communities, and our employers, when our schools are losing ground to neighboring states, it's time to change. Standing still is the same as stepping backwards when we're fighting for our economic lives in an accelerated world. ESCO Corporation needs better trained workers, and this package of bills is one productive step toward better outcomes in Oregon's classrooms. This package isn't perfect for anyone, but it's right for everyone, for now. So while I love my sisters, I don't relish kissing them. And while large Oregon employers like ESCO don't relish these bills, we love this state and want to see a path toward more competitiveness, more hiring, and more shared prosperity. We urge both parties to do more to give us long-term tax reform while correcting the unfunded PERS problem that constrains our growth. For now, please pass these bills on September 30th. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. And thank you for staying within the time limit. I'm sure it was difficult. I mean that. So thank you very much. The next group to take the field, Randy Miller, John Calhoun, Jessica Stewart, John Mullen. I think that's right. And the next group that will come forward, Philip Kennedy Wong, I believe, Marcia Kelly, Chuck Shuckatoff, and Judy Weiser. So that will be the next group to take the field. So would Randy Miller proceed, please?
Thank you. Randy Miller, born and raised in fifth generation Oregonian, live in Portland. And you'll think I'm nuts when I make this next statement, but if you add up all the different boards and committees I'm on, it totals 34. And everything from economic development to chairing the co-chairing with the former First Lady of the Oregon 150 to arts and housing and healthcare, all this. And the reason I'm saying that is because I want to indicate that my perspective is for one of breadth, not because I'm representing a particular constituency. And that, I think, is very, very valuable because I'm looking at the interests of the whole state, as you're trying to do now in this very, very difficult situation which you're under with all the various kinds of testimony, including my friends who disagrees with me. I think what we have to understand, too, is why over the last several years we've been unable to fund essential services, and why has Oregon been consistently had one of the highest unemployment rates in the United States, and also why in the past we've been unable to attract the type of business capital and the job creation that we've all been trying to look for. And in 35 years of working on economic development, especially relative to business attraction and retention, which I've done through many, many organizations, the bottom line is we just haven't been competitive. And that has, based upon the tax policy that we've got, and as a result have been lacking in tax income that absolutely happens to live up to our potential. And business attraction and retention does take particular elements, which you've certainly heard about a lot, but being tax competitive in tax policy is an essential part of it. And does this particular set of bills or this concept really lead to the total tax reform we need? No. But there are certain elements to it, I think, that are extremely valuable, which could add to the fundamental growth and the foundation for future economic growth, and particularly as it relates to education. Many will argue that we should just raise income taxes on the higher income earners. But we have learned that what that does is repel.
Randy.
Okay.
Sorry.
It does repel.
I understand. Jeez, I hate doing that. John Calhoun.
Thank you, Co-Chair Courtney, Co-Chair Kotak, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Calhoun, and I'm an entrepreneur and investor from Portland, currently managing partner of Inside Valuation Partners, LLC. And I'm also co-chair of the Equity Alliance of Oregon, a group of business owners and business leaders. Our concern, as we stated during the regular session, is with the reduction in tax rates for owners of S-Corps, LLCs, and LLPs, including myself. We remain opposed to the concept because it would mean that wealthy business owners would pay a lower tax rate than their employees. To us, that is fundamentally unfair. You have tried to address our concern regarding the potential for abuse of this tax reduction, leading to larger than budgeted revenue loss by readjusting rates up if the total tax expenditure grows above a base level. We are pleased with this modification, but are concerned that may take too long to react to the amounts jump much faster, and hope that you could tighten this up with an annual review. However, even though you have attempted to address some of our concerns, this tax cut will provide the vast bulk of its benefits to the wealthiest members of our state, with little or no payoff for the rest of the citizens. Let me state categorically, it will not create measurable additional jobs in Oregon. It is not a small business incentive package. It is nothing more than a payoff to a handful of rich folks who generally do not operate small businesses, as this term is generally understood by the public. What makes this proposal particularly galling is that over the past 30 years, our state and nation have seen increasingly wealth disparity that is damaging to our democracy and our society. We have suggested other business tax cut proposals as alternatives to this specific tax cut that are tied to employment and are more broad-based, such as reducing unemployment tax rates and backfilling with general funds. As business owners, we want to see Oregon continue to grow more prosperous as we emerge from the recession for all our citizens, not just a wealthy few.
Thank you.
You do better than I did.
Jessica, please.
Co-Chair Courtney, Co-Chair Kotak, members of the committee, my name is Jessica Stewart, and I'm a resident of Portland. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Center for Christian Voices. OCCV is a faith-based nonprofit seeking to activate Christians on issues of economic and social justice. We believe a budget is a moral document and that our budget reflects who and what is important and who and what is not. We strongly support the proposed investments in education, mental health care, and services to the elderly, as well as increases to EITC that are contained in this special session's budget proposal. However, we question the morality of cutting taxes for the wealthiest members of our state as part of this package. Under this proposal, business owners would pay lower taxes than their employees. How can this be justified? Over the past few decades, income disparity has grown both in Oregon and in the rest of the country at an alarming rate. This problem is not helped by reducing the tax burden on the wealthy and accelerating this economic injustice. Please remember that our budget reflects our values and priorities. We ask that you consider this when you decide on giving tax breaks to those who are not in need. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. John Mullen, please.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen here on behalf of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. We've been around since the 1980s, providing advocacy for basic needs for low-income and vulnerable Oregonians. I want to begin very quickly by talking about our tax and revenue principles, which are fairness. It has to do with who pays, how progressive, adequacy, making sure we have enough money for the budget for the things that we need as Oregonians, stability. We have a very volatile system, as we all know, here in the state of Oregon, and transparency. These are complex issues that the public needs to understand. Coincidentally, that spells out FAST, if you look at that as an acronym, and I'm going to speak fast because I have very little time. But I do want to comment on a couple of things that relate to our mission and to our principles. First of all, we hope that you'll give some consideration to the revenue in the out years and what you're promising in terms of investments. I think these are they're troubling when we look at the numbers to see how this is going to work out. Specific to senior medical, HISCO has long supported changing that. I just would point out that one of the changes that we're concerned about is the lifting of the age. The other things, converting to a subtraction, very good for low-income people. Targeting it and limiting it is also very good, but we hope that you take a look at younger baby boomers who are pre-Medicare age. They're very vulnerable. The earned income tax credit, we've long been on record supporting an increase in the earned income tax credit. We're really good with that. The tobacco tax we've also supported. So in the end, we're very happy about the investments, but also know that we're going to be back talking about these issues in February and beyond because we don't have our tax and revenue system that works perfectly. We'll continue to be working at it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. Our next group to testify, Philip Kennedy Wong, Marcia Kelly, Chuck Chuckatoff, Judy Weiser, and then the two remaining individuals who've signed up on LC3 would be Chuck Riley and Arthur Towers, or they will be waiting, as I say, to come onto the field. If there's anyone else on LC3 that hasn't signed up, please feel free to do so.
President Courtney and Speaker Kotek and members of the committee.
Just let me get my breath here. So everybody understand, anybody else out there wants to talk on LC3 and you haven't signed up, please feel free to sign up because following this group, we have Chuck Riley and Arthur Towers, and no one else is on the sign-up sheet, I don't believe, for LC3. Okay, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I just wanted to get people's attention by talking over and over again. All right. Philip Kennedy Wong, please.
President Courtney and Speaker Kotek, members of the committee, for record, Philip Kennedy Wong. I'll keep my my comments brief because I know I'm sitting next to Chuck Chuckatoff, who will probably use a lot of my time. Just kidding.
Exactly.
But we are here. Oregon Food Bank is thankful for the inclusion of the earned income tax credit in this package. We don't have any other. We don't have a position, obviously, on any of the other parts of the package because we are a food bank organization. We are primarily concerned with low-income Oregonians who are struggling to make ends meet. The one thing I do want to point out in my testimony is what has become very, very clear for folks involved in food banking is that a full-time job isn't a guarantee of not going hungry anymore, which is very, very unfortunate. If you look at the charts that that's part of my testimony, you'll see that the number of people that do come to emergency food banks, they come for a lot of reasons related to the high cost of making ends meet. You'll see, obviously, running out of SNAP benefits as a result of high inflation and food prices to gasoline, utilities, rent. And you will also see that about 30% of folks that are coming to food banks are actually working in some degree or another, whether it's full-time but not making enough money or part-time and obviously certainly not making enough to make ends meet. But they come to the food banks to get that 3 to 5 day supply of food, not because they're trying to avoid working at all, but because it does help them to pay some of their other bills by freeing up some of their scarce dollars to be able to go into it. So their earned income tax credit, as you will see, is a great tool that matches well with what the food bank tries to do. So we hope that you will you'll keep this packet and hopefully in the future consider increasing the refundability. Thank you.
Thank you. Marcia, would you like to speak, please?
Chair Courtney, Chair Kotek, and members of the committee, I'm Marcia Kelly from the American Association of University Women. There are parts of this, quote, grand bargain that AUW could support, the earned income tax credit, increasing the cigarette tax, and to some extent senior medical deduction. I at first had concerns about the age, but I think if the age is ratcheted up to or down to 65, whichever way you want to figure the ratcheting, as the Affordable Care Act comes in, then I wouldn't have quite as many concerns. However, this is not a grand bargain. There's not going to be a grand bargain in taxes until you look at the other side of the taxes, and that's the property taxes and what Ballot Measure 5 did in 1990 to skewer the way that we spend money in Oregon. So all in all, putting the burden on retirees and lifting the burden on wealthier Oregonians and not addressing the property tax. This is a bargain, maybe, but it's not a grand bargain.
Thank you. Chuck. Chuckatoff, please.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. Chuck Chuckatoff, executive director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy. We've submitted to the record two documents, a short five-page issue brief titled A Grandly Flawed Bargain, and then a slideshow that also explains why we believe that with a little bit more data, but in pictures. We have three main concerns with the tax package portion of this, and I'll suggest some fixes to those. First is, it has shrinking revenues over time. You're asking to invest $200 million in good investments in education, health care, seniors, and mental health care, but over time, that money declines by 87% when you include the earned income tax credit. Bit less than that if you don't include any credit, but you lose the money over time. And it's also an unsure estimate of the cost of that. And the reason it goes down is because of the pass-through business tax subsidy. The LRO isn't sure of the numbers. There's been some discussion about having a safety valve provision. If it costs 25% or more than projected, would go down. I suggest you use the constitutionally established 2% for the kicker. If it costs more than 2%, then you change the rates. You raise the rates. It also needs a sunset. It's preferential tax treatment, so under ORS 291.201, it's a tax expenditure. If this were after January 1, House Bill 3367 that you passed last session would require it have a sunset, and I think you ought to put a six-year sunset on it for a lot of reasons, because it's cost, if you were going to do it. It's largely a tax cut for the top 1% because most small businesses won't be able to use this. They'll pick the option of staying with the current rates. And then last, it's not going to create any jobs except for the CPAs who get to figure out your taxes using two different systems and see whether it helps your business or not. And so it might create a CPA job or two, but there's no jobs attached to the tax cut. Thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Jody Weiser, please.
We think that the LC3, which of course we haven't read yet, is a concept that should break the grand deal because it's...
Excuse me, your name, please.
I'm sorry, Jody Weiser with
Thank
Tax
you.
Fairness Oregon.
Okay.
The business owner tax breaks basically will set up a Warren Buffett kind of situation where employees will pay a higher rate of tax than their employers, and that is not been in the Oregon tax code since the 80s, and it's not time to return it now when in your district, I imagine that few of you will find people who will say, yep, the bosses should get a tax break because somehow they're different than the employees in the state. It doesn't sound to me like an idea that would go with the public. It's unless there is a sunset on it, it'll be nearly impossible to step back from something that's going to, next biennium, cost us a week of school or 1,000 teachers. That's what $100 million a year buys. Can we afford to be making that kind of decision in order to give money to somebody, to a few individuals in the state? Because it's probably, thousands, tens of thousands, but it's certainly not the grand bargain that we should be looking at when we're trying to figure out how to take care of our kids and the other needs in our state. So these really aren't small business tax cuts. They're business owner tax subsidies or tax breaks. And it's not about whether the business is large or small. It's about whether you happen to have your income passed through this entity or not. I think what people don't realize is that the income that an owner has that they don't take a salary is already tax advantaged because there are no social taxes paid on that income. So they're already paying a lower tax rate than their employees. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. So we did have a couple more sign-ups. So Chuck Rowley, Arthur Towers, Patty Whitney Weiss, and Jan Meekums. If those individuals would like to come forward, please. take one of the chairs. Okay, Chuck, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair. Chuck Riley. Today I'm representing Tax Fairness Oregon, but I'm also a owner of a small business, which you can find by going to Chuck Riley Photography online. I have a couple of issues that I don't understand why this august body is doing, and that is I have a couple of neighbors who are actually wine growers, and they have their farms right across the road from each other. One of them actually sells almost all of his wine to in the Northwest, and the other one sells most of his wine in Canada. I don't quite understand why one of these people gets a break when they all both use the same amount of water. They use Oregon soil. They have Oregon employees. But one gets a tax break under the IC disc and the other doesn't. I don't quite understand why you would do that. The other issue is, and it's been talked about before, I don't know that if I have an employee and I'm working side by side with that employee, we're doing the same job basically, except I happen to own the business and take my money out of that business under a pass-through, why I should get a tax break and make pay lower taxes than my friend and employee sitting next to me. Thank you.
Thank you. Arthur Towers, please.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Arthur Towers, political director for Service Employees Union Local 503. Yeah, I recognize that things are moving forward and the you know, perhaps this is a foregone conclusion, but we do simply want to register our opposition to LC3 for many of the reasons that have been mentioned earlier on. We're at a time of growing and near record income inequality in America and in Oregon. LC3 makes matters worse, not better. And the size of the tax break for wealthy business owners in the biennium is very, very troubling. You know, a lot of the money is being set aside for K-12. That's where our members' kids and grandkids go to school. But our kids need teachers. They don't need temps. And that's the structure that we have set up here under the formula in LC3. So I'll conclude my remarks there and appreciate the time.
Thank you. Patty Whitney Weiss, please.
Thank you. Patty Whitney Wise with the Oregon Hunger Task Force. I'm here representing Oregonians for Working Families today. You heard from us a lot during session about increasing the earned income tax credit in order for low-income working families to be able to meet their basic needs. And I'd like to just remind you that increasing that earned income tax credit is tied to food security. If people are able to keep more of their wages, they're able to provide those basic needs for their families. It's tied to economic development. The earned income tax credit has been shown to create jobs throughout this country and in Oregon as well. It's tied to work. Families have to be working and earn wages in order to receive the earned income tax credit. And it's tied to education. There are some very good long-term studies that show families who receive the earned income tax credit, their children are able to do better in school. So for all those reasons, we support that measure. And if I could take off the hat of the coalition for a minute and go back to my role as the Oregon Hunger Task Force, many of these families fall in the same income range as some of the lowest income retirees with PERS. And I have a concern that we're going to be creating food insecurity for people in that same income range who are retired. I would feel a lot better if at least the people in the first $20,000 of retirement were able to keep that 2% a year increase, because otherwise over time we'll have to as a state figure out how to support them. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Recognize, please, Jan Meekums, please.
Thank you, Chair Senator Courtney and
Co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Jan Meekums. I'm the state director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. We've been in the business of advocating for small business. This is our 70th anniversary. We have 7,500 small business, many Main Street businesses around the state. They're up and down the I-5 corridor. They're in the rural areas of Eastern Oregon, and then they're in the metro Portland area. We've had a lot of discussion regarding the revenue and tax package and PERS reform before us today and before you. And they have decided that they are in support of the package. There are elements that they don't like, but addressing mainly the small business and small business tax reform, it offers them a ray of hope and some certainty. And as the governor said, small business represents 97% of all employers and over half. In fact, I read today about 60% of the new jobs are coming from the small employer. About over 70% of our members pay their taxes on a personal basis, usually and often as pass-through entities. So this tax break for them is a huge difference. When you look at the Affordable Care Act being implemented, you look at tax increases being talked about at the federal level, tax increases at the state level, and paid sick leave, minimum wage going up. And if you believe the philosophy that the economy is based on confidence and certainty, that confidence and certainty has been greatly undermined during the Great Recession and in the present time. This is the first, I think, movement that they've seen that they have something that they can, that will improve their business. And I applaud you for the work that went into this, and we support it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for your testimony. This completes the sign-up sheet for LC3. Calling once, calling twice. Anyone else wish to speak on LC3? We'll now move to the LC4, which Mr. Cannaracco explained, as well as handed out written documentation, the budget appropriation measure. Patty Whitney Weiss.
You turned me off. I signed up under the wrong one.
Oh, okay. Cosette Reese. Philip Kennedy Wong.
You can also cross me off as well.
Okay, he's gone. This could get very interesting. I'm not trying to stop you from testifying. I'm just calling your name. I hope that doesn't discourage you. Cosetta Reese, and if I said that wrong, you'll tell me, is this Byers, Marge Byer? Cynthia Thompson, and how about Sean Gillespie? How about that? So I don't know who's here and who's not, so please, oh, they're all here. So, Cosette, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
I did okay.
You're doing great.
So please present, give us your name and then go forward on LC4, the appropriation measure.
Well, good morning, members and chairs of this committee. My name is Cosette Reese. I'm the Accessible Services Manager at Lane Transit District in Eugene, Oregon. I also serve on the Public Transit Advisory Committee, which is an advisory committee for the Oregon Transportation Commission and the Oregon Department of Oregon Department of Transportation's Public Transit Division in matters of policy and investment strategies for public transit. So I'm here today to support the proposal to allocate funds toward transportation services to seniors and people with disabilities. Transit agencies are obligated under the Americans with Disabilities Act to provide transportation for older adults and people with disabilities. Now, as you know, nationwide, the baby boom generation is retiring and approaching retirement. By the year 2030, the elderly and people with disabilities will comprise 28% of the population of Oregon. The rides that we provide these folks are a lifeline that allow them to get to medical appointments, jobs, and grocery shopping. Keeping seniors in their homes is critical for their health, and it also saves the state money. For many low-income elderly and disabled Oregonians, the difference between living in a care facility and living independently is their mobility. These services, however, are expensive, and LTD has been left to pick up the costs as state funding has been held constant, yet costs and demand continue to rise. Transportation providers such as Lane Transit District have implemented many strategies that are innovative to gain efficiencies and stretch our dollars as far as we can, such as partnerships with private providers and collaborations with other organizations. Yet LTD pays 75% of our paratransit operations out of our general fund. So increased costs in the paratransit world means less funding in our general fund. That also supports our fixed route public transit system, which also supports services to seniors and people with disabilities. Thank you.
Sorry.
No, you're perfect. Thanks.
Is Margaret Myers, what's the first name?
Marja.
Oh, Marja. All right. Well, I'm sorry. I apologize. That's I got the last name right. I done it, Marja. So please forgive me, Marja. Please proceed.
Thank you for allowing me to speak this morning. My name is Marja Byers. I'm a legally blind Salem resident, lifetime Salem resident. I also work at Blind Skills, which is a local nonprofit. We publish Dialogue magazine as well as disseminate information and find resources for people living with vision loss, both locally and across the country. I want to speak today. I have a vested interest, both personally and professionally, in public transportation and the accessibility to people with disabilities. But today I want to speak on a personal level. I have been able to work with the nonprofit Ride Connections up in Portland. They have a RideWise program that offers travel training to seniors and people with disabilities at no cost. Because of that training, I've been able to travel confidently and independently between Salem and Portland. Access to Portland has allowed me work, connections with family and friends to improve quality of life, and very importantly, it has allowed me to get medical attention that I need because I cannot get that level of care in Salem. Last January, because of that training, I was able to get to the Casey Eye Institute by myself and have surgery done by their team to help save the vision that I do have left, which is hugely important to me. Now, on the more negative side, I live here in Salem with my husband, who is also a non-driver, and my 25-year-old autistic son, also a non-driver. We are completely dependent on public transportation in a town that has no weekend public transportation or paratransport. And I really would like to see support of those systems to keep us as independent as possible and to keep people living with vision loss from driving because they have no other choice on the weekends. Thank you.
And thank you.
Cynthia? Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing us to speak today. My name is Cynthia Thompson, and I am a small business owner and also working currently for Ride Connection in Portland, Oregon. I've spent the last 20-plus years in the public transportation industry in both rural and urban systems. And also have lived with somebody with a disability for 23 years. And so I kind of live and breathe this whole thing, and I'm not going to repeat what my colleague said, so I'm going to focus on a couple things. Demand is growing, continually growing, and resources are flat or declining. And if there's one thing you could do, I think you have a real opportunity with this bill. You have $5 million set aside for public transportation. I wish you would double it or triple it or quadruple it. But whatever you can do, add to it, because I think the ripple effect of investing in public transit and especially in services for elderly and people with disabilities is really significant. And I don't think we think about it very often. But, for example, TriMet spends $30 million a year on their what they call paratransit, their Lyft service. That's out of their general fund dollars. And for every additional dollar you could get and spend to provide services for elderly and disabled, that frees up money that they can spend on every other transportation service that they offer, which then benefits the youth, it benefits everyone, it benefits commuters, and that's true for every system. Eugene, you know, you name it, all of them have the same need. The demand just keeps growing, and so I would just strongly encourage you to consider the importance of this. I know it's not sexy. It's not. It seems to be always on the bottom of the list. I remember I was talking about $5 million 20 years ago. I wish it was $20 million. I mean, I want to honor the elderly and people with disabilities. They are what makes the fabric of our communities what it is. And I don't want them all. I don't want to be in homes. I don't want them to be in homes, so thank you.
Thank you. Sean Gillespie, please.
Yes, my name is Sean Gillespie. Thank you all for allowing me to testify. I'm a constituent specifically of Senator Courtney and Representative Clem, but obviously a constituent of all of you since you all affect my life. Thank you very much also for the support of the autism insurance reform this past session, for starters. You obviously all see the need for this law, and I want to share with you a way to not only help the fight of autism, but also help the fight of Oregon fight the battle of this economy, increasing jobs, education, and maximizing our resources. Oregon now, as a result of the law, needs to have a great amount of applied behavioral analysis analysts and assistants by 2015 to comply with the portion on there as to what's going to be acceptable by the insurance companies to be able to do this training on here. According to the board that does certify schools, there is only one school, University of Oregon, that's authorized to train actual analysts, and there's only one school, Oregon Institute of Technology, that's actually authorized to certify those that are aides or assistants to those analysts, which is a pretty arduous task. Is it something that Oregon can handle? Well, sure, we've done it before. We vote by mail, we do the bottle bill, we handle a lot of other things that we can handle, so it's not anything that Oregon can't handle. The challenge that we have is that trying to find enough ways to get this information to the people and get them trained and certified. I guess this is the plan that I had, at least a beginning part of it on here, and I'd like to discuss more. Schools right now, besides PTA meetings and as well sporting and music events, they are generally unused. They also are capable of holding large amounts of people as well as multimedia and be able to conduct that information widespread. There are also areas where kids go to school and also in their neighborhoods. Why can't we use those facilities as training facilities? I'd like to be able to contact people afterwards as well. Thank you. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you very much for coming here. Didn't mean to. Jonathan Ames, Ryan Deckert, Leah Rogers, and not Leah Rogers. Okay. Thank you. So Jonathan Ames and Ryan Deckert are the last two individuals signed up for LC4. Anyone else wishes to sign up for the budget appropriation bill, please feel free to do so.
Chair Courtney, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Eames, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Residential Providers Association and Cascadia Behavioral Health. And I just want to say and start out by saying thank you. And thank you for your work on the mental health piece of the spending bill. This is a tremendous opportunity. And you not only through the last legislative session, but also through this dedication of funds have really provided a game-changing investment for mental health. And I think it's important for you all to understand that and how the good that you're doing out there. The tremendous amount of funds that you did this last legislative session have already started to work and will be implemented in the next this year and in future, in the next year of the biennium and hopefully future biennium. We talk a lot about the social determinants of health, the things that people don't know about that are beyond treatment, such as housing and peer-delivered support. You've put into this plan dollars that are dedicated towards that, and you should be proud that you're doing that. That's really going to help people thrive. It's not just about the mental illness. It's also about their situation, whether they have a job, whether they have safe housing, whether they have access to care. Those are all the things that you guys are doing in this dedication. The other thing I'd like to say is the fact that you are dedicating it. This is the first time that funds have actually been dedicated towards mental health. You're taking a portion of the cigarette tax revenue and dedicating it. This will hopefully be an ongoing investment in future biennia that we can count on. We dedicate funds to other things, but never to mental health. And so this is a tremendous change, and I want to say from behalf of the folks that are providing the treatment, and I know the advocates and the actual people that are actually receiving the dollars, thank you very much.
Thank you. Ryan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair. Ryan Deckert, the President of the Oregon Business Association. I am dedicated to not getting that red light. I feel like I'm at the DMV right now with green, yellow, red. Mr. Chair, I think it was Winston Churchill, I believe it was, who said that representative democracy is the worst and most horrible form of government except all the others. And I think you could pack this hearing room with folks that would look at a big, major compromise and see provisions in it that they don't support. I can tell you, we had our board retreat last week, and we represent a number of the major C-Corps in the state, I think eight of the biggest 10. And to a person and to a company, they asked, and these are our brand name companies in the state, they asked, why are we having a major corporate tax increase when we have $1 billion more in state revenue? And some of these companies are folks that aren't the names that we all know, but they are employing thousands and thousands of manufacturing jobs in the state. And the answer that we unanimously came to as a board was to do big things for the state. And the biggest thing that you can do is start. We have an embarrassingly short academic calendar in our schools and universities. It's embarrassing. It's one of the, I think, third lowest in the country. We have some of the highest class sizes. And you've seen the data of the initial numbers of teachers you're going to be able to add back to Oregon classrooms and days to the calendar with the legislation that you crafted, Mahonia Hall. It is game-changing numbers. I know some of them are 190 in Portland. I think it's 75 in Bend, or 50 in Bend, and more in Medford. And so statewide, you are making a huge difference for Oregon classrooms, universities, and making a tough decision. And for that, we really do. We applaud you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. That completes the sign-up list for LC4. We do have two individuals who have signed up to talk on the GMO bill, LC5. So would Leah Rogers come forward and Harriet Fassenfest? I don't know. I did the best I could. I'm sure we'll get the right pronunciation. So thank you.
I have a quick question. Has LC5 come out yet? Have you guys seen it? It's still not. Okay.
I don't. The answer is no. Leah, proceed.
Good morning. Thank you very much for this opportunity to testify. My name is Leah Rogers. I am a small farmer in East Portland. Rockwood Urban Farm is the name of my farm. And I just quickly want to say that I wish I could have seen LC5 before this, but given that I haven't, what I know so far is that it's very broad and would specifically prohibit local communities from setting food and agriculture policies, particularly those aimed at regulating or managing GE foods and crops, genetically engineered, genetically modified. And LC5 has the potential to overturn a wide range of local food and agricultural ordinances already in place, even though it's meant to protect local ag from threats like invasive species. The local GE policy efforts are in part due to the lack of action at state and federal level, and the same groups most strongly supportive of Senate Bill 633 or LC5 are also most vocal opponents of every bill during the regular 2013 session that would have clarified and strengthened statewide policies. LC5 has no place in this complicated pension and tax reform package, and given the all-or-nothing approach, it throws farmers and local communities under the bus, pitting farmers against children, essentially. I would argue that preempting local control contradicts the governor's statements this morning regarding this package fostering Oregonians' ability to self-govern. I respectfully request that you oppose LC5 and all aspects of any package that contain this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Harriet, please.
Hi. My name is Harriet Fassenfest, and I'm a small backyard farmer. I'm just an advocate of small farmers in general. And I apologize because I just read this, wrote this as I was. So I'm going to try and read my own writing. So I oppose the inclusion of LC5 into this legislation, and I want to speak on a few levels. First, in regard to jobs growth, which this seems to be, the larger legislation seems to be about, the growth of small local organic farming and the farming movement is one of the shining stars in Oregon's economy, as is represented by Kitzhaber's recent declaration of Oregon, the Organically Grown in Oregon Week, which is September 15th to 21st. This movement not only has created jobs and given our reputation, attracted young, hopeful farmers from other states to our area, it has significantly defined Oregon as a destination spot for tourism and thereby has grown all the attendant businesses that thrive from it. And I'm sure the Department of the Chamber of Commerce has figures to support that. I will respectfully suggest that no one will visit Oregon for its growing genetically modified food industry. On the subject of equity and social justice, which I believe is at the heart of this legislative concept, the birth and growth of the local organic food movement is in response to the social, environmental, and economic concerns of those concerns. And as a group, we small farmers work with residents of the urban and rural areas to reach not only food security, but full health and nutrition. After a recent viewing of the movie, A Place at the Table, a documentary dealing with the growth of hunger in America, I learned that hunger is not merely a matter of enough to eat, but what is being eaten. And a strong correlation was made between nutritional insecurity and those foods produced and distributed within the industrial food system, which...
Harriet, I need to ask you to stop.
Stop?
Yes, please.
It's so good, though.
I'm just getting going.
I'm sorry.
Literary genius.
I'm very
you know what I'm trying to get at.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for your
thank you
both. Thank you very much. Thank you both for your testimony. Again, that's good. But I just want to, before that, I want to ask, is there anyone else who can hear my voice inside the building, outside the building, wherever you are, who wants to speak on the PERS issue that we discussed yesterday? The BMO issue that we discussed yesterday. Excuse me. You wish to speak?
Yes.
So please come forward and tell us your name and if you could identify the issue, please.
Yes, actually, I am a PERS member, as is my husband.
What is your name, please?
My name is Lori Benoit. My husband is Alan Benoit.
Okay, and I assume you want to speak on the PERS proposal that we considered yesterday?
Yes.
And that was LC.
One and two.
That was LC 1 and 2. Please proceed.
Yes. And also about the GMOs. I don't think they should be tied either to both. But with the PERS, my husband is a, 26-year PERS member and is going to be 65 in March. I just retired in June because I was an inactive PERS. You guys were looking at the money match, and you're taking all this these steps that are going to be detrimental to our family. We are not going to be able to recover from this because, like I said, he's going to be 65 and looking at retirement. The way that you've gone about it is wrong. This, where you're going to vote on Monday and tying all these bills together is wrong. GMOs are wrong. Like they said, they should be able to, each county should be able to make their own decisions on that. And with our retirement, it needs to be done. In February, you can come back and maybe look at it. But, you know, rushing this through September 30th on these items on so many levels, morally, I think it's wrong. I think that there is a problem in the schools. I went to school here in Portland grade school, high school, graduated, went to Oregon State, graduated from Oregon State. So I've seen what's happened over the last, 40 years that I was in school, and our son, who just last month turned 20, he was a teenager. He also was born and reared here and went to schools and graduated from Sam Barlow. There are problems in our schools. Our schools are bad, but it's not, you can't attack PERS and then our foods. You're going about it totally the wrong way. You have to, it is a revenue problem, but it also it has to do with how our education is set up and how we fund our education as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any others who wish to speak? Senator Burdick, did you have some questions you wanted to ask?
Yes, Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me, I did have a legal question that I wanted to pose to counsel, if we could just take a moment to do that.
Sorry. Counsel here?
Yep.
He's now.
There he is.
We didn't have Chuck yesterday for LC5, so. Or we had him leave.
Okay, your questions, please.
Good morning, members. For the record, Chuck Taylor, Legislative Council's office.
Thank you for coming by, Chuck. I just had a legal technical question about LC5 and just want to get it on the record. I believe I know what the answer is, but I wanted to have it on the record. And the question is, does LC5 in its concept, and it derives from Senate Bill 633, does this restrict the ability of local governments to regulate noxious, nuisance, or invasive plants or seeds?
Chairs and Senator Burdick, I think it is going to be sort of a case-by-case analysis. Generally, I would say no, because what the bill prohibits are efforts to inhibit or prevent agricultural production. And most weed control efforts are really about helping to bolster or ensure that production. I have looked at a couple of weed control statutes. For instance, I have looked at the current Jackson County ordinance and the Hood River ordinance and did not see anything in those that I felt conflicted with the Senate Bill 633 prohibition. That said, there's always the reason I say case-by-case basis is you could always wind up with an odd definition of what constitutes a noxious weed. If you recall back to last session, the regular session, when we had the canola bill up, I think half of the people were calling it a commodity and half were calling it an invasive weed, depending on which camp you were listening to. So with that caution that you never know what might wind up in a weed control provision, generally I don't think this would restrict the ability of a local government to do that.
Thank you for getting that on the record.
Follow-up?
Yes, Speaker Cote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chuck, thank you for being here, and thank you for coming back since we had you here yesterday, but we wanted to get to public testimony. So to follow up on Senator Burdick's question, is it likely that every county who has any kind of food-related agriculture food policy on the books, city, county, local government, they'll have to do their due diligence of 633 passes to make sure that they are not out of compliance with state law if that passes? How would you suggest they do this? I hear AOC is in support of the bill, but and LOC, but at local level there are policies that are agricultural-related. How do you suppose they will handle this?
Chair Kotek, obviously they would want to review any policies that they have in place. I think you have to keep in mind what the scope of Section 3 is, which is prohibiting laws to prevent or inhibit the use of agricultural seeds or products of those seeds. And that takes in kind of a broad range of activity. So, yes, there is a lot of potential there for local laws to touch on those subjects. I read the language in Section 3 really as indicating that the local law needs to either have preventing or inhibiting the agricultural production as a substantial reason, or it would have to have some kind of disparate impact. I don't read it as prohibiting some kind of a law of general application. For instance, if you had a city with a noise ordinance that would limit processing noises or something, the fact that they're processing an agricultural product under Section 3, even though it Section 3 would prohibit a law to prevent or inhibit processing of an agricultural product, I don't think it is going to preempt that type of a general application law. I think it has to be something that is a law that is more targeted. As far as being able to determine whether they are in or out of compliance, the law is added to a series that is administered by the State Department of Agriculture. So I think that they would be the primary resource to look to when the local governments are trying to figure out what is in or what is out.
Thank you.
Yes,
that led to another follow-up question. So I'm at a disadvantage because I don't have a draft in front of me. But it was my understanding that this, the intent of this was to prevent local governments from enacting restrictions on this type of activity. But there are a bunch of areas that already have noxious weed, weed control ordinances. Are you telling me that this, the scope of this law, as you understand it, could reach back and get to ordinances that are already in place?
Chair, Senator Burdick, what it prohibits is enacting or enforcing a law. So enforcing, yes, would apply to a pre-existing law. So if that law is one that prevents, is a law to prevent or inhibit the production or use of agricultural seed or the seed products, then yes, that would be impacted. What I was saying in response to your earlier question is I don't think that the weed control statutes that I have looked at, in particular the current Jackson County one and the Hood River ordinance, are laws that have that effect.
Sounds like we're opening up a legal can of worms, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, may I?
Yes, Representative Garrett.
Just while we're on the subject, you know, Senator Devil and I represent a community that has had for several decades an ordinance restricting removal of trees. I can't imagine that's intended to be within the scope of this bill, but the language referring to ordinances that inhibit the use of a product of a seed arguably seems to me could be stretched to include that. What's your opinion on that?
Chair Garrett,
we're getting way off.
The trees would be within the definition of nursery seed. So again, I think you get back to what is the purpose or effect of that law. Is it a law to prevent or inhibit production? So it depends really on what your ordinance says. If it is a disease control issue, the ordinances that I've looked at from Jackson County and Hood River have disease control measures that include forced removal of diseased trees. That, I think, is not in conflict with Section 3.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Fairley.
Mr. Chair, I disagree with my colleague, as I often do, about a can of worms. This is a tin of red herrings that we're opening here. It's really clear that the purpose of this whole preemption ordinance is about genetically modified crops. So, if there is a ordinance in Eugene, Oregon, protecting genetically modified trees on the skyline, it would affect it. But it's not. There is no such ordinance. And I think the simple answer is that this law isn't intended to conflict with noxious weed controls or nuisance abatement or any of the other stuff that you'd usually and customarily find in the ordinances of a county. What it specifically deals with is genetically modified material, and it says that those policies will be set by the state. So let's not go far afield and try to raise a cloud over this issue when really that is more of a political tactic than any other thing that I can see. I appreciate the question. I thought the question was a clarifying question. The answer that I heard is that in the two instances where we had an analysis in Jackson County and Hood River, there are no conflicts. And I'm assuming that if there were conflicts, the AOC or the Associated Oregon Counties would come forward and say, this is going to be a problem for us. They did not do that. They came and said, we support this thing. So, you know, if there is some clarifications needed, I'm going to rely on the 36 county governments acting through their Association of Oregon Counties to help bring forward a model ordinance if there is any conflict. They've testified in support. I don't believe there's a conflict. You want to look for a conflict? Go look. I think what you're doing is looking for red herrings. Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Are there further questions of the City Council? Representative McClain, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Taylor, is it your understanding that the LC concept, which is based on Senate Bill 633, is for the purpose of the regulation of the production of agriculture? And you referred to this phrase prohibiting or inhibiting the production of agriculture. Is that your understanding?
Co-Chair McClain, yes, it is written to agriculture and agricultural production.
And that being the legislative intent and that being the words of at least the legacy bill of 633, in the areas of our state which prohibit in our cities production of agriculture by land use laws, would they not by definition be exempt from any reach of 633?
Be exempted?
Meaning if the land use laws of the state prohibit agriculture production in certain areas of the state, there any laws with county laws which would regulate trees or moss or anything like that would by definition not be for the purposes of inhibiting agriculture.
Co-Chair McClain, the exact interaction of land use laws and agricultural production, in particular some of the right to farm statutes, is rather muddled. I would basically repeat what I said earlier, is that it is looking in 633 when it talks about preventing or inhibiting. I think you are looking at laws that either have that as a substantial purpose or have it as a substantial effect. And so, again, if it's a generally applicable provision, I don't see that as being impacted, whether it is in land use or something else.
Then I would agree, and, Mr. Chair, I just point that out because it is part of what I believe the legislative intent is, and that this is an agriculture-based preemption so that we can set state policies. It is not intended to interfere with urban areas that where agriculture production is already prohibited. And we're talking about the agriculture-focused preemption. And so it is certainly not, I believe, the intent of this to have a impact on county ordinances that have other applications in by a general application may have some impact. And I think we do that all the time. We have a land use planning that's based upon state. And so it is quite appropriate for the legislature to also set land use, or I should say agriculture use, at a statewide as well.
Representative Barnhart, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I represent a number of cities and border a number of other cities in my district. The only one I know about for certain that has laws involving street trees, noxious weeds, and a variety of other things related to it is the city of Eugene. And I would appreciate it if you would take a look at their ordinances and see if you think that this proposal that we're talking about would cause a problem for the city of Eugene. And then I have a comment, if I could. I grow a garden in my yard. We have a flower garden and we have a vegetable garden. It's in an R1 zone. I don't think it's at all, I mean, depending upon the way this bill finally drafts out, I don't think it's at all clear that this isn't an agricultural use or whatever the term is. Because I eat the tomatoes and the cucumbers that I grow, and so do the members of my family. And we put the flowers in the middle of the dining room table. We also have community gardens in Eugene and in other communities where people cooperatively work raising very small plots in the community garden. Those are also covered by rules. I don't know whether they're covered by city ordinances or not. But if the city or the people who provide the rules for these community gardens are unable to enforce reasonable rules around the use of those gardens, then this, because of this bill, then that becomes a significant problem. I would appreciate it if you look into that issue as well. I wish it were as simple as Representative McLean suggests. I don't think it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I thought you made a comment for him to look into things.
Well, I did ask him to look into it. He may have an answer now.
And if I may, I do have an answer to the second part of your question. And that is that in Section 3, Subsection 2 of the bill, it says that it does not apply to preempt a local government from regulating what happens on its own property. So in the case of the community gardens, if that is owned by the local government and they're making that available for residents to use in raising, I think they do have the power to regulate what goes on in the community gardens. And I would be happy, of course, to look at the Eugene statute for
you. Thank you. Just to clarify, if I could, is a school district then a local government for this purpose?
Representative Barnhart, I am not certain whether they are included in the list of districts that are in the definition of local government. You'll notice we tied into a statutory definition, 174.116, which is going to cover cities, counties, boards, commissions, and a great big long laundry list of special districts. And I'm sorry, I don't know offhand if a school district is one of those districts or not.
Thank you.
Sir Devlin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just first of all, I just want to respectfully disagree with Representative McLean in the sense that I do know that in my particular area, while there are ordinances prohibiting certain types of livestock in residential areas, but there are no ordinances that I'm aware of limiting someone growing crops in their backyards, and some of them are quite large, actually, and I actually have a lot of, in my district, I have actually a lot of Christmas tree production, not as much as other areas of the state, but I have some. But the other issue I wanted to put forward, I think, which is a broader issue, is that most of the concepts that we have been discussing over the last few days were discussed either the same concept or similar concepts during the regular long session. And the reality for all of us, and all of us are somewhat experienced legislators who have been here for quite a long time, some of us, is that it doesn't matter if it's in a special session, a long session, we routinely have to come back and tweak statutes that we pass. And it's just part of the nature of our work. We have some relatively complex issues here. I mean, I think in particular, we're talking a lot about the one relative to GMOs. The second PERS statute, the second LC2,
the one that has the three aspects in it. I can almost guarantee you that there'll need to be a little bit of tweaking of that one in the future. But all of us should expect that while we try to get a good product in everything that we do, that we often have to come back and tweak what we have done. It's just not uncommon at all.
All right. Thank you, Scott. It's been refreshing. Anything else for the good of the order? Thank the members of the Senate. Thank the members of the House for coming and participating in the public hearing yesterday and today. Being on this committee, we will meet again on Monday. I do not know when we're going to meet, right? We haven't set a time for this committee to meet on Monday.
You're going to have bills.
8:30.
Did you want to read this, Mr. Chair?
Well, apparently we've been scheduled to meet at 8:30. That assumes we get off the House and Senate floor in time, because we do have business to do in the House and Senate floor. But 8:30, I guess, in the same committee room. So with that, if there's nothing else anyone else wants to talk about?
No, I'm sure.
Discuss? Okay, I better shut this down. We are adjourned.